All right, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Last week, we just barely got started talking about how science and the scriptures relate to each other. And of course, as you know, for years now, over 100 years, there's been a tremendous amount of controversy and contention between Christians and their views of science and scripture and the scientific community. And that has not gotten much closer to resolution over all these many years. Although it's an American phenomenon, the Christian church and other parts of the world don't experience quite this same crisis. But in this country, it's a big, big deal. And yet, I think on both sides, the tendency is to not very clearly state your case and know exactly where you stand. So this I found helpful to me. In fact, I should tell you this. I grew up kind of reading science books and always found science fascinating. It's not long before you do that, you run into the theory of evolution. I remember distinctly in the sixth grade mentioning evolution in a conversation. I forget why I brought it up, but we were talking between classes or something. And some kid goes, that's a dirty word. I'll tell the teacher. So that was kind of the attitude where I grew up. And I remember also as a junior high student, we'd say middle school today, I asked my dad how to reconcile what I'm reading in these in magazines and papers and such, and the and scriptures, how all that fits together. And when I was in the sixth grade, the answer was, well, God had to explain it in terms that could be understood by people wandering in the desert who had just come from Egyptian slavery. All right, by the eighth grade, a phenomenon had arisen which is often called creation science. And the argument was made that, correctly understood, science supports the 6,000-year-old Earth. And young Earth creationism kind of came back. Because until that point, for decades, the majority view within much of Christianity in the United States was kind of the gap theory, which is that all the stuff the geologists and the biologists and paleontologists are discovering about dinosaurs and rocks is true. That happened before the 6 days of creation, and there is this gap. But the scientific creationist community, which was founded by a guy named Henry Morris, took the opposite view and said, no, science actually supports a 6,000-year-old Earth. And that quickly caught on, and in a lot of circles and a lot of congregations became the official position. So doctrine changed. And there have since been just all kinds of debates and such over that issue. And I grew up reading that literature. And so I have taken, I think, every position it's possible to take on these issues over the years. At the same time, Dr. Hugh Ross is a geologist within the Churches of Christ, and in the late 60s, early 70s, he began teaching old earth creationism, contradicting scientific creationism, and has for years, I mean 30, 40 years now, gone around the country, taught classes. He's got a newsletter that a lot of people subscribe to called Does God Exist? And his point is, of course he exists, but he deals with the science and Bible controversy in that newsletter, as well as speaking around the country. And we've got some of his literature in the church library. There's a little green book called Does God Exist? By John Clayton. I said that wrong. It's John Clayton. Actually quite excellent. It's just a collection of essays from his newsletter. So within the Churches of Christ, there have been both schools of thought. In fact, when I was in high school, Batzel Barrett Baxter, who at that time was the face of the and voice of the Churches of Christ on the Herald of Truth TV show, which was syndicated all over the country. I mean, you can go anywhere you want to. Somewhere there was some channel that had the Herald Truth on Sunday morning and Basil Barrett Baxter sharing from the Word of God. And he was the senior minister at the Hillsborough congregation and at that time head of the Lipscomb Bible Department. He published a book called I Believe Because, which was on apologetics, Christian evidences, and he took an old earth position, which at the time was not all that controversial. Although less than maybe 5 years later, you'd be damned for taking that position. So you gotta be my age to remember all of this, you know. But so we went from, in the late, I think he published that in 68 or so, we went from that being, you know, a little controversial, but I mean, the guy was like as prominent and as influential within the Churches of Christ as anyone could be at that time. And he didn't get disfellowshipped over it or written up. People bought his book. I had it in high school class growing up. And then not many years later, when the scientific creationist literature came out, a book called Scientific Creationism by Henry Morris, it's in the church library too, both of them are, took the young earth view, and then suddenly the old earth view became heresy. So I just want to give you some historical context. These are kind of the theories that I think are worth talking about. First, there's young earth creationism. And it fits into two categories. One is God made earth look old. Actually quite popular. And the theory is this. You get your telescopes out, and you see stars and galaxies, and if you get out a really good telescope like the Hubble telescope, you see the formation of stars 12, 13 billion years, light years away, best we can tell. Well, that doesn't really fit with the 6,000-year-old Earth. So the theory is, well, God made the light from these events in transit. Just like when Adam and Eve were made, God made them not as babies, but as, you know, full-grown adults. We would assume in their young 20s, because that's when we felt healthiest. It's been downhill ever since, you know. We figured God made Adam out on the uphill side, right? But he probably had a navel, and he looked like an adult. So, you know, if you put him in a CAT scanner, he would have all the adult features of an adult. And so he made the earth and the universe that way. So the fossils and the geological layers, they're just there to make the earth look old, full grown, as it were. But it's not real. Yeah, that's kind of my reaction. Played with that for a little while, but my problem with that theory is that the scriptures say, if you want to learn about God, look at his creation. Look at the stars. Look at the earth. Look at the animals. Look at whatever. God made it. The art speaks about the artist. Well, if the art tells a story that didn't happen, what does that say about the artist? You see? So if you take that view, I think the only way you could even take it that makes any sense at all is to say, God told a story. It's God's story. I'm going to study and learn from that story. So if that's your point of view, you should be a devoted paleontologist, cosmologist, astronomer, biologist. It all came from the hands of God. He wrote the story. Now, there's a minority position that I can't find any books on. Nobody really believes. People teach it, but it's never gotten enough credibility to actually make it into the publishing industry, which is, well, Satan snuck all that stuff in there, right? Which the problem with that is, no, God made it. God says, look at it, you'll find me, not that you'll find Satan, right? So, now, the thing about God made the earth look old is it's scientifically unprovable and undisprovable, right? Because if God did it right, then the science says it's old. So there's no scientific basis to make that claim, which is fine. You don't have to have a scientific basis to believe what you believe, but to me, it's not consistent with Scripture. And then the other young earth view is called scientific creationism, which is a Henry Morrow school of thought. It's only about 40 years old, but it says the science says the earth is young. Okay. I put this on the on my blog to test it. I mean, I have readers, you know, a few, all over the world. Type should I? Well, it's due. And I said, because I think it's true, but I wanted to test it before I got in class and said it. I don't think there's any science at all behind scientific creationism. None. Zero. Although that used to be my own personal point of view, and I have taught classes that said that. But one of the beauties of the internet is it's really easy to test the claims. One of the major institutions that teaches this and publishes literature and teaches seminars and such had a list of the top 10 reasons they believe the earth is only, scientific reasons they believe the earth is only 6,000 years old, and went through and in about 30 seconds each found that every one of them was false, and provably so. In fact, there had been literature published and well-publicized that said this is a false claim, and yet it was still on the website. So, frankly, the guys who teach this, not the people who believe it, but the people who teach this, are often intellectually dishonest. They continue to publish things even after they have been disproven. So I find it very dangerous, and say, if you want, you don't have to agree with me on this. We'll all be in heaven together. We'll go ask Jesus, and he will tell us who is right. All right? And we'll still be in heaven afterwards, both of us, okay? Should not be a salvation issue, no matter how strongly either side feels about it. But
would that be the Ken Ham answers in Genesis, kind of, is that school of thought?
Or Apologetics Press? Apologetics Press would be in the scientific creationism school, without a doubt.
And I think this, the Ken Ham people out in Texas.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that term.
Yeah, they're building a life-size ark in Ohio, Cleveland, or somewhere.
Yeah.
They're pretty big. Check them out.
Well, there's a lot. It's an industry. It's huge. You know, major publishing houses print the literature. You know, just for example, you know, there's just so many. But for weeks, people would write in and post and say, well, what about this? What about this? And, you know, it's been going on for 40 years. There's a lot of whatabouts. A lot of arguments made, scientific claims made, but every one of them, I mean, you just Google the question and up pops the answer, and there will be a very clear scientific answer that that is just not true. Okay? So it's one thing to say as a matter of faith, I believe the earth's only 6,000 years old. I mean, that's fine, but to say as a matter of science, it's only 6,000 years old, then you subject yourself to a certain level of scrutiny you have to be willing to submit to, right? You have to be able to prove it as a matter of science. And as a matter of science, the science doesn't hold up. And we can spend, you know, whatever amount of time we need to on that, but I want to make kind of a subsidiary point to that, which is, I think, important. It took me a long time to figure this out, like 60 years, but there's a lot of literature out there within the Christian creationist press, pro and con on evolution. Almost all of it con. My position on that is don't care. Right? And let me explain that, because it's really simple, actually, when you think about it. It took me forever to figure this out. Like, I mean, just a few weeks ago it came to me. But if you prove if you found videotape of the creation of life and it showed God making it, it was not evolution, okay? If you could prove to a scientific certainty that there was no evolution, you would still have to contend with the fact that the astronomy and the geology makes the Earth billions of years old. And what people don't realize, because, I mean, we're not 19th century people, but in the 19th century, the idea that the Earth and the universe is ancient came first, evolution came afterwards. The idea of ancient geology, of dinosaurs being hundreds of millions of years in the past or tens of millions of years in the past, did not come about in order to support Darwin. That was figured out long before Darwin by scientists who were mainly Christian in the 19th century. And that created the puzzle about, well, how did all this happen? How do we fit into scriptures and such? But the puzzle, those ideas and theories were not created to support Darwin. Right? Darwin came later. In fact, what happened is not Darwin wrote Origin of the Species, but Fulton invented the steam and the steamboat, right? James Watt created the steam engine, and Alfred Nobel invented dynamite, and all of a sudden it was possible to build canals and roads and railroads. And they started knocking down the sides of hills and mountains and digging tunnels, and they would find fossils. And at first it was, oh, this is really cool, and this is from the flood, right? But then they noticed that, well, the most recent fossils, the one on the top of the stack, are mammals. Saber-toothed tigers, woolly mammoths, right? And then you get a little deeper, you find giant lizards. We'll call them dinosaurs. And then you get even deeper, you find ocean creatures, trilobites and such as that. And the layers in that order were consistent across the planet. And if there was a flood, why are the mammals always on top? And why are the dinosaurs, even the swimming dinosaurs, on the bottom? You would think the swimmers would be on top, or not there at all, right? And then the geologists became, over time, more and more sophisticated about understanding how geological deposits come about. As John Clayton says in his book, he went to the Grand Canyon, and you look, and there are layers that are the shape of ancient sand dunes. And the mathematics and the physics of how sand dunes are formed, the angles at which they're created, are very precise and well understood by geologists. And that's how they look right there in Arizona. Well, why is that true here in the middle of the desert? The flood would not explain sand dunes, right? It might wash sand up in a big pile, but it would not create dunes. That comes from the wind. You know, so you start, those kind of questions got asked, and for decades it was various flood theories, and then somebody said, well, maybe the Earth is really, really old, and maybe we've been misreading scripture all this time. And so various theories were created as to how to adapt or understand scriptures in light of the discoveries. And then some scientists, geologists, said, let's figure out how old this really is. Well, this is long before you could do the kind of testing that's done today using radioactive isotopes and such. That wasn't known. But they said, well, look, this mountain has clearly eroded. We can do studies to figure out how rapidly it's eroding today and kind of go backwards, and that will be very crude because, you know, things change, right? But give us a sense of how old it is. And they started coming up with dates in the tens of millions of years. For that, for volcano, I mean, for all kinds of things, right? You just start getting out your measuring tapes, and you know you're not exact. And then later on, in the 20th century, when they started coming up with mass spectrometry, with the ability to measure isotopes and understanding how atoms work and things, and they realized some of these things are actually capable of giving you a clock that runs on a scale of hundreds of millions of years. And they gave you different dates, but consistent with the old theories. You know, it might be 200 million years instead of 75 million years, but it's nothing like 6,000 years. And so the dating was done. And then only after that is anybody willing to give Darwin even a hearing, because it was understanding the order in which things occurred and the fact that these layers are consistent that gave rise to the question of, well, why is it that the Triceratops is this age and yet there are different versions of Triceratops type animals, the Ceratop class, at different ages? How did that happen? And how do we see these transitions occur? And that was the question Darwin was trying to answer, but it was because of other things, right? So even if evolution proves not to be the mechanism for how the animal shapes and types changed over the eons, we still got animal shapes and types shaming. We still changing. We still got many layers within the Earth, and they are like that. Now, the scientific creationist community in the 1970s had won in Arkansas a legislative victory, which required the schools to teach both the scientific theory of old Earth and the scientific creationist theory of young Earth in the schools. And lawsuit was brought, it was challenged in the federal courts, and testimony was given. There is, I think it's in Montana, don't hold me to that, maybe Wyoming, but somewhere in that part of the world, there's a place where the rocks are in the opposite order, where the mammals are on the bottom and the trilobites are on the top and the dinosaurs are still in the middle. And if you read the creationist literature of the time, they quote scientific journals and say, look, if you stand back and look at this formation, it's obvious that the order is backwards. On cross-examination, it was revealed that the quote did not end at backwards. It continued to say, but if you walk up close, it's obvious that this is a thrust fault formation where the rocks were thrown up and laid over on their side. But not in the literature. And they asked the guy who wrote the book on cross-examination, well, why'd you stop the quote there? Isn't that a little misleading? And he answered, well, you got to stop somewhere. And that's what when I read that case, I thought, there is something amiss in scientific creation land. Because I'd be disbarred for doing that. even lawyers are held to higher standards than that. it's not a letter grade kind of mistake. You get kicked out of school. So that started me checking. Right? I decided, well, you got to look. You may be familiar with the claims about Paluxy. P-A-L-U-X-Y, is a location where they have found, supposedly, human footprints alongside dinosaur footprints in clay that has since gotten hardened and become fossilized and such. That's, I think, in Texas. There's several books out there just about that, and clearly proving that dinosaurs lived at the same time as man. Maybe that's the Nephilim mentioned in Genesis and unknown. Well, it has been shown, and the son of Henry Morris has conceded that, in fact, those are dinosaur footprints. And if you follow them far enough, you'll see the dinosaurs were walking like on their toes, and then later on they would go back on their heel, and you can see very clearly the lizard-like formations. But what had happened is they stepped in the mud in a desert, infrequent rain, right? And but for a while, the mud kind of seeped, and it made it look like human footprints, some of which are like 3 feet long. And, so you take a picture over here, it looks really human. You take a picture over here, it looks really dinosaur, and it's the same critter. It's the same path. And so the creationist kind of headquarters, the Scientific Creation Society, Henry Morris and his son, have withdrawn that. But it's still being published. You still find it on websites. You still see the claims being made. And again, it's not hard to look this up on Google. It takes about 10 seconds. All you have to do is wonder. Pop it in, up comes the answer. In fact, you can look at my blog if you care, but there's a link to a lengthy article by the guy who actually made this discovery and invited the scientific creationist guys to come look. And how hard that was. They eventually did come look, and they went and explored and walked all through this, and that resulted in withdrawal of these claims. So it's not to say that everybody in the scientific creationist community is intellectually dishonest. Those guys were honest enough to admit that that claim did not stand. But there's a lot of intellectual dishonesty in that world. So there's still a lot of claims being made that have long since been disproved. So back to my point. So even if evolution is provably false, the Earth still looks like it's really old. And the stars look to be really far away. And if you were to actually count the stars, there's a lot of them to count, but, you know, like a trillion trillion. Is that a quintillion? No, it's bigger than that. It's a it's a huge number. If you brought them all within 6,000 light years, you'd have to wear sunglasses at night and a whole lot of sunscreen, too. I mean, that'd be right. They can't be that close. So, personally, and again, as a matter of doctrine, don't care. I find the scientific creationist hypothesis unsupportable. And every claim I've been able to come across and checked doesn't stand. In the 1970s, things were very different. There were a lot of discoveries hadn't been made and such. But now, it just, you know, it's running on fumes. And the courts have long since stopped taking it seriously because it's been tested in the courtroom and did not stand up well. And it wasn't just, oh, this is Christian, therefore we're not going to do it. It was, oh, this doesn't stand up as science. And that's important to know, I think. But one of the great dangers, and this is going on right now, it's a huge, huge problem in Christianity, is people will say, unless you accept one of these two views, you must be an atheist. Because these are the only Christian views. And we at our church, this is the only views we're willing to accept. These are the only things we believe. All else is a pathway to atheism. And if you go to college and they teach you this stuff and you believe it, you're going to go straight to hell. And a lot of the children of Christians have, in fact, gone to college and thought, well, actually, the earth really is old. Well, then I guess what my teacher said in high school class was right. God doesn't exist. Because they put forward that as the test. If you want to know if God exists, test me on this. Is the earth 6,000 years old or not? And that's the test for God's existence. And that test has not worked out so well for us. And if you read the literature, literally you get the book Scientific Creationism that started this all right there in chapter 1 or 2. There's a quote that says, if you believe in evolution, you cannot believe in God. Guess who they quote? An atheist. Actually, two atheists. And I've always thought, why are we getting our doctrinal positions from atheists? You know, it's like getting military strategy from the Nazis in World War II. Why would you do that? I mean, these guys are not on our side. So we should take our strategies not from the atheistic playbook, because the way those... No, you know, a lot of atheists really just don't care about this stuff, but those who wish to defeat Christianity, and you know, that's becoming a more popular position, want to use evolution and the age of the earth as their crowbar and say, I can persuade you the earth is old, that contradicts scripture, therefore you cannot believe scripture, therefore you cannot believe in God, therefore you must be an atheist, okay? And when we say, yes, that logic is right, we just disagree about how old the earth is, then we have leaned into the punch. And oh, goodness, tens of thousands of people have left Christianity because they grew up in churches where they were told you cannot believe in science and in God. Right? Whereas the scriptures say, look at the earth, look at the stars, they speak of God. Right? I happen to think that's true. So I love reading scientific material. I've subscribed to Discover magazine and such, and like reading that, and I don't care what the editor's interpretation is, not my concern. It speaks of the glory of God. And so when I see the photographs of the Hubble telescope of things that happened evidently 13 billion years ago, see stars being formed, some of those pictures actually called the hand of God. I think that really is the hand of God. Right? It's not just overblown rhetoric from NASA. I think it's the truth. Yeah, I think dinosaurs are just fascinating and real. They really happened, and I think God did it because it was fun. Okay? Because if you're God, the world's your playpen, right? You can do what you want to do.
He made a platypus.
He made a platypus. That's right. Obviously has a sense of humor. So that brings us to old earth creationism. And there are just all kinds of theories, but there is the atheist, deist, and agnostic points of view. Atheist, of course, means I believe there is no God. I take that position, right? Deist says, yes, there is a God, but I don't really know who that is. Haven't met him, not going to meet him. He doesn't care. Okay? Deism was extremely popular in the 18th century when the United States was founded. Jefferson was a deist. Franklin was a deist. Because they were fans of the French, who helped us out in the war, of course. And the French were largely deist. And in the French Revolution, they banned Christianity, turned the Temple of Notre Dame into the Temple of Reason, killed the bishops and such on the guillotine, and found France ungovernable. Right? They tried to run it as an atheistic state in the 18th century. It was ungovernable. They had to reallow Catholicism as their form of Christianity back in as a legalized religion. But that's what was going on. The American Revolution was not about deism or anti-church at all. But the intellectuals, many of them were highly influenced by the French. And then the agnostic position is, don't know. Right? There may be a God, may not be, but the evidence is not clear. So these are all kind of functionally the same. Right? There's a God, but he's so distant it doesn't really matter. And maybe the way you explain how the universe got started and the Big Bang was created, maybe there's some deity out there that did it, but he sure doesn't care about us. We are mere specks in the grand scheme of things. We don't need to worry about no God. Well, that's not a scientific claim, right? It's a philosophical claim. It's a religious claim. And there is no scientific evidence for or against that position. I mean, it's just outside of science. So when scientists say, my science disproves God, well, no, not really possible. Science does not address those questions. It gets close, but can't get there. And so then you got the old earth creationism claim, which is the earth very ancient, but it was made by God. And then within that category, there's the board's not big enough to list the theories as to how to reconcile the scriptures and what we discover when we take up God's challenge and look to see what's there. But I want to mention two or three. In Baxter's book, I believe because there's a series of chapters on theories about how to reconcile Genesis 1 with the scientific evidence. There is the gap theory that there's a gap between Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and then the 6 days of creation, which is very similar to the creation-recreation theory, which says that God created it all, there's no record of that, and then he recreated it 6,000 years ago. The problem with that is the geological records don't show a discontinuity 6,000 years ago, just not there. So I'm personally not a gap theorist. In the last few years, a book has come out by a guy named John Walton. He's actually published two books, one for the scholarly community and one for the rest of us, on this question. Walton is a scholar of ancient Near Eastern literature. He has studied the writings of the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, all those people, the Phoenicians, who were there at the time of Moses. And so he's one of the few experts in the world about how people, in the 1500 BC, when Moses wrote, thought. And he's put forth a perspective that has caught hold in the scientific community, in the Christian community. And it's based on Psalm 32. I think I've got it right here, and I think I remember the verse correctly. Psalm 132. Verse 8. Arise, O Lord, and go to your resting place, you and the ark of your might. Let your priests be clothed with righteousness, and let your saints shout for joy. For the sake of your servant David, do not turn away the face of your anointed one. Where is God's resting place in context? Not a trick question. But I don't know, I have been dominating the conversation.
Possibly the Ark of the Covenant?
Yeah, where's the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, at that time, the temple was not in the temple yet.
But Jerusalem.
Being held by the priest.
Yeah. Don't know if this was... this is probably written after David, because it talks about David. You know, verse 1 says, remember, O Lord, in David's favor, all the hardships he endured. So this comes from a later psalmist, still inspired, right? So actually, when this was written, the temple was built in Jerusalem. Holy of Holies had the Ark of the Covenant, and above that the mercy seat, and God sat there, enthroned, as king of all Israel. I mean, the human king served as an under-king below God as the true king. And he rested in the midst of his temple. Well, in the ancient Near East, and even in the first century, the gods were said to rest in their temples. That was their resting place. And when a temple was built and dedicated, the last thing that would happen is the gods would come into their temples and rest. And so Walton's argument is, he says, look, in the ancient world, the text about building temples are filled with stories about how the temple was built, how it was dedicated, and how at the end they placed an image of God in the temple. And that was not, they knew that was not the God, right? The statue of Venus was not actually Venus, but that was the image of Venus. But then at the end of the dedicatory ceremony, which typically took 7 days, God would come to rest in the temple. So he says, we, humankind, made in the image of God, what that means is we're God's representatives on earth. We serve the same purpose in the universe as God's, as Venus's image does in her temple. Man is God's image in his temple, which is everything. God built the universe as a place for him to be worshipped. Mankind is his image. And so we are to show the world, those of us who are God followers, we are to show the world what God looks like. And we're to draw people toward God, as Venus's image was to draw people toward Venus. And you don't worship the image, but you worship because the image helps you to see and understand what you are worshiping. So if we're truly the images of God, then we show the universe and show other people who are not God followers what God looks like. Right? And then upon putting his image in his universe, then God came to rest. And then in Hebrews chapter 3, 4, and on throughout the book, really, it's a major theme in Hebrews. The Hebrews writer invites his readers to join God in his rest. Well, that's not a literal 24-hour day, because according to the writer of Hebrews, God's still resting. Except God's been very active. In fact, if you were writing in the late first century when Hebrews was written, probably, or mid first century, you would see God as being extremely active. So resting doesn't mean taking a nap, sitting up with your heels up. It means coming to be situated in your permanent place and do what gods and temples do, which is take care of their people, you know, grant miracles, bring people to true worship, and benevolently take care of those who follow him, okay? That's rest. It's a radically different sense of how we have interpreted it, but in ancient Near Eastern terminology, which we see in Psalm 132, and there's another verse that says the same thing, God's resting place is where he acts as God. Right? When you go to the temple, which, by the way, the temple of the Jews and the tabernacle were built on a template that imitates the creation. There was a basin called the sea. There were stars and moons and you know, celestial images sewn into the curtains. And you can go through in some detail, and Josephus, of all people, lays this out in great detail, that the temple was built as a microcosm of the universe, and the tabernacle like it before that. So when God came to dwell in the tabernacle and later in the temple, he was imitating what he had already done to come and dwell in his universe. And the temple and the tabernacle had as one of their messages to humanity is the God who lives here doesn't really just live here. He lives everywhere. And this is not really just his temple. This is a place of his special dwelling, but the whole universe is a place of his special dwelling. Right, so if you actually physically visited the temple, you would see that. And then at the temple, that's where you go to make sacrifices, but also where you go to pray. That's where God has special presence and concern. Right? I mean, when Solomon dedicated the temple, God's glowing, shiny presence came in. It was so bright that priests couldn't perform their duties because it was so bright. Because God's presence was there, but Solomon said in his dedicatory prayer, of course, no temple can contain God. God is everywhere, right? But he had a special, intense presence there. And so Genesis 1 concludes with, and God comes into his temple and rests, and the universe is his temple, and the people of God are his images. And it makes really good sense if you look at it from that perspective, and you can get his book and read other parallel poems or accounts of the dedication of other temples around the ancient Near East and see the parallels for yourself. I mean, they're there. So it's a very different way of looking at it, but it's a way that actually fits quite nicely, not just with the Psalms, but with the entire New Testament. And the fact that scriptures as a whole, the New Testament very loudly keeps saying, you are made in God's image. We're going to restore you into God. You're going to be the image of Christ. You're going to be a new creation, meaning the old creation repaired and completed, right? Those images of the word image, the word likeness, you can do a concordance search. It's very helpful. I've done this more than once. Just get on Bible Gateway or something, type in likeness or image or creation or new creation, and read all the verses and the passages. And a significant major theme throughout the New Testament is Jesus is coming back to restore us to be the images we were meant to be. Well, why? Well, not just because we're supposed to look like God, whatever God looks like, but it's supposed to be show the world who God is. See? That's the concept in the New Testament, and therefore it's the concept in Genesis, and it fits. All right, see y'all next week.